This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Shall we begin with prayer? Our Father, for the time together that we have, we ask for your blessing. We thank you for the investment of time and ask that this would be fruitful for your service, that you would be here among us, with us, guiding us. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so workshop description, so you're in the right place. And my first question would be, how many of you are in K-12 education? How many of you are in that field? So it's only two of you. And then can I assume that the rest are in higher education, college, grad level, or will be? And so I really wasn't sure what I was going to get. All right. In terms of my own background, I have some literature there. I work for an organization called Institute for the Study of Asian American Christianity, but my career basically has been in two places, either the seminary classroom, and I teach Bible, not education, I teach Bible, and the pastorate. I've pastored for many years, so I have small church, large church experience. And in developing this workshop, I was given the title of Faith and Pedagogy. And looking at it from my perspective, you know, I'm always in a situation where I'm supposed to talk about faith matters, right? I'm supposed to talk about it. And I said, well, what would it look like in a secular classroom? You know, how can we talk about these same issues in a secular classroom? And so that's what led me to this particular workshop. You know, I've done some reading, and there really are a lot of similarities, I think, between secular and religious classrooms. The content is somewhat different, but a lot of the dynamics are the same. And so this is what we're going to explore. You know, how can we talk about spiritual issues? And we will. You know, I've tried to define spiritual in this, and we'll talk a little bit more about it, but this is, you know, how I would define spiritual. Let me begin then with a story about a young man named Eugene. Eugene was a high school student in New York City, and he was trained in resolving conflicts. He was trained in this particular program which they had in his school, and he was a peer mediator. So it was his job as a student to help resolve conflicts among other students, between other students, among other students. And so Eugene was trained in this. And when he was asked at the age of 18 what his life goal was, he said it was to be alive at 21. Well, that's the context of his situation. You know, the rough city, South Bronx, very, very rough neighborhood. His goal was to be alive at 21. A year after he graduated, he was on a street corner. Some shots rang out. He was an innocent bystander, but he was struck by one of the bullets, and he was paralyzed from the waist down. Now, the woman who had begun this conflict resolution program in his school was very hesitant about going to visit him. Several days later, she gathered up enough courage where she could visit him in the hospital. And when she saw him, she asked him, she said, Eugene, how are you? He said, I wasn't doing too great until this morning. That's when I got up and decided to find a place in my heart to forgive the man who shot me. And so she says, how are you able to do that? And he said, it's because I knew that I could have been the man who pulled that trigger if I didn't know there was a better way. The better way. I think even as Christians, you know, how difficult would it be for us to forgive someone who shoots us, paralyzes us for the rest of our lives? And here is a young man who, as far as I know, is not even a Christian, but able to find the better way. Well, that's what we want to talk about, the better way. And within the context of our theme for this weekend, human flourishing, the better way. You know, how can we do that? Let me see. So in terms of education, teachers, K-12 K-12. Now, these are the K-12 teachers who are asked this question. And these are teachers from around the world in different workshops and settings. They were asked this question. If you could go to bed tonight and wake up in the morning with the power to ensure that you could teach one thing to all the children of the world, what would it be? Now, I'm going to give you 2 minutes to buddy up. And if you can think, as an educator, how would you answer that question? And share that with your neighbor. So give you 2 minutes, 1 or 2 minutes, just to say hello to each other if you don't know each other. And how would you answer that question? Okay, you have your answers? All right, so what are some of the answers that you came up with? How would you answer this? What were some of the answers? So give your partner's answer, right? So you don't, so you know, we can be humble. It's not your answer, it's your partner's answer. If you thought your partner had a good answer, what was it? What were some of the answers that came out?
If I could teach only one thing, I had the opportunity to do it, I would teach statement that says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and
I might come up with
the
Father. Right. Okay. Right. But, okay. Of course, that would be in a religious context if you could, but.
Not necessarily.
Uh huh. Okay.
Not necessarily.
Okay. Some other answers?
Yes. Conflict resolution.
Conflict resolution. How to get along with each other. Right, to play nicely. Okay, some other answers.
Integration.
Okay, that's interesting. And so that, again, has to do with community issues, right? Is that what you mean by integration?
No.
Okay, what do you mean then?
Yeah.
How would you define integration?
The opposite of differentiation.
Oh, okay. Okay. Right.
I was just trying to kind of throw it out there in terms of comparison of the kind of things you're supposed to teach with the kind of things you might want to teach.
Uh-huh. But this is what the one thing that you would want to teach to the children of the world. All right. Some other answers?
Passion for truth.
Okay. Passion for truth. Well, I don't know if you represent the answers, but around the world, these are the answers. And, of course, most of you are more in higher ed, but I think there are a lot of similarities. These are the answers that they came up with. That children feel loved, or you could say that your students feel loved, that they know they have a purpose, that they learn tolerance and compassion, and that they have a sense of their interconnectedness and uniqueness. Conflict resolution's in there somewhere. But these are the common answers that they received. And again, these are K-12 teachers, but if you transpose this to higher ed, is this something you would want your students also to know, that they are loved somehow, that they have a purpose in life, that they learn how to relate to other people? When citizens were asked in a poll, and they were asked the question, what types of skills do you need to survive and to do well in the 21st century, 80% of them said that you need skills that are different from what was taught 20 years ago. Just 20 years ago. Another survey, 272 global thinkers, were asked what values are important for the world community. And these are the answers that they came up with. Compassion, honesty, fairness, responsibility, respect. So these are the five answers and values that they came up with. These really are a little bit different from the subject matters that we teach. And yet, you know, the other survey and this survey, and in the next one, the American Academy of Educators, American Association of School Administrators, asked 50 education leaders, what do students need to know and be able to do? What behaviors would they need in order to thrive during the next century? These are the top, you know, two of the top answers that came out. Civility and ethical behavior. Again, not what you normally teach within your classroom. So here we are, and if you're in, you know, K-12, you have reading proficiency tests, math standards that you have, that your students have to meet, and in higher ed classroom, we're trying to teach our subject matter, and yet these are the skills that students need in order to thrive and survive in the 21st century. You know, this is part of human flourishing, the better way that our young man Eugene was talking about. And a lot of the work that's been done, especially in the last 10 years, really have been on the K-12 level in these areas. Far, far less on the college level and up. UCLA did a study, it's published in 2006, asking college students about spiritual issues, whether this was something that they wanted to talk about. And I don't know if you're familiar with the study, but the students said yes. Then when they surveyed their professors and asked their professors that same question, most of the professors were themselves personally interested in spiritual issues, but they did not want to talk about it in the classroom because they didn't feel that they could. And so the students want to talk about it. The professors don't feel that they can, or perhaps they don't feel comfortable talking about it. You know, so how, especially as Christians, you know, how can we talk about it in a way that will help our students? And again, a lot of this work has been done on the K-12 level last 10 years, so we're going to take a look at some of those things, and also we're going to transpose here and there, and you can do it yourself, transpose it to a higher education level. You know, how can you do this in your setting? And what the professors came up with, you know, they had professors from different schools that were part of this UCLA survey. They talked among themselves, thinking, what are some of the things that we could do to promote spirituality or to talk about spiritual issues in the classroom? The answers they came up with were very similar to what primary schools and secondary schools are doing. It's all very similar, just on a different level. So what would then, so when we talk about touching the inner life of students, spiritual issues, let's look at some definitions. So when we talk about spirit, we're talking about the vital principle or animating force with living things. I mean, these are just some definitions that we can work with. The general atmosphere of a place or situation, the effect that it has on people, a fundamental emotional and activating principle determining one's character, and this comes from, here's my source for these various definitions of spirit. It does not have to do with any one religion, right? But just a general definition that we're working with in terms of spirit. You know, something inner within us, some animating force, something that drives us, some emotional activating principle. And then when we talk about the word soul, here's some other definitions. The immaterial part of a person, the actuating cause of an individual life, deep feeling or emotion. The soul, according to many religious and philosophical traditions, is the self-aware essence unique to a particular living being, and this is from good old Wikipedia. So when you look at these particular definitions of spirit and soul, and you use this in a secular setting, they talk about schools having spirit, or touching the souls of students. These are the types of definitions that they're working with. Not necessarily, you know, our Christian definitions, but it's close enough, and this is what they mean. So if you try to have schools with spirit, what would they look like? And here are some of the, explanations of what a school with spirit would look like. We would acknowledge our interconnectedness with one another and with all of life by a commitment to ecological principles, environmental limits, and social responsibility. We would enlarge our ability to put to use our gifts of intuition, imagination, and creativity. We would value personal change as a vehicle for systemic change and social justice. There would be places and times for silence and stillness to help us face the chaos and complexity of school life, yet stay in touch with inner truth and the web of interconnectedness. We would pay as much attention to whether a student knows his or her unique purpose in life as we do to his or her SAT scores. And this last one, I think, is what really maybe picks our interests as Christian educators, to talk with students about values, meaning in life, purpose in life, and how you can contribute to the world at large. Well, in Illinois, these are some of the... I'm ahead of myself. So if you summarize what a school of spirit values, it comes down to three areas usually. The first is self-knowledge. The second is healthy interpersonal relationships. And the last would be building community. That when you take the various explanations, outcomes of what a school spirit would look like, you can divide it basically into these three areas. That students would be more aware of who they are, self-knowledge, including their own emotions. That they would have healthy interpersonal relationships with their peers, and that they would be part of community concerns, building on something greater than themselves. In the state of Illinois, and we are in Illinois, these are some of the goals of the Department of Education in Illinois. To develop self-awareness and self-management skills to achieve school and life success. Use social awareness and interpersonal skills to establish and maintain positive relationships. Demonstrate decision-making skills and responsible behaviors in personal, school, and community contexts. It's exactly the same three that we just looked at. Self-awareness, social awareness, responsible behavior in the community. And I think President-elect Obama's new Secretary of Education comes from the Chicago School District. So there might be some of this now being played out in general education policies across the United States. But it is these three areas. And when you look at these three areas, does it remind you of anything in Scripture? I'm referring to the two great commandments, and especially the second one. Love your neighbor as yourself. When we teach people to be more aware of who they are, to understand themselves better, to control themselves better, when we teach them to get along with others better, when we teach people, students, to work within a greater community for the good of the community, is that also not part of what it means to love your neighbor? And so, isn't that what we try to do as teachers? We're trying to transform lives. We want to transform lives. That's why we're in education. We want to be part of that process. So what happens then when we don't? What happens when we don't teach these types of skills? People know all too well what intelligence without social skills looks like in kids. It can look like individuals who are obsessed with their own success and status, but are indifferent to the plight of others. It can look like youth who are unable to sustain employment because they cannot get along with their coworkers. It can look like the many young people who resort to an array of self-destructive behavior because they are unable to communicate their pain and grief and confusion to anyone else. And this is from the Education Commission of the States. So we, you know, this is what it looks like when we don't develop the whole person. If we only concentrate on the academic, like math scores, reading scores, we don't touch the whole person. This is what we produce, or could possibly produce. So how does separation of church and state play into this, right? This was the fear of the professors. You know, how can we talk about this without violating the First Amendment, without violating the issue of separation of church and state? This is from the Education Secretary's Department. And this is their statement on teaching values. Though schools must be neutral with respect to religion, they may play an active role with respect to teaching civic values and virtues and the moral code that holds us together as a community. The fact that some of these values are held also by religions does not make it unlawful to teach them in school. So we can talk about moral values, civic values, virtue. Can't teach the Ten Commandments, but we can talk about general principles of morality. Furthermore, we'll really push our time, so I'm sorry if I keep going. I don't even allow too much time for comment right now. Student assignments. This is what the statement says. Students may express their beliefs about religion in the form of homework, artwork, and other written and oral assignments free of discrimination based on the religious content of their submissions. Such home and classroom work should be judged by ordinary academic standards of substance and relevance and against other legitimate pedagogical concerns identified by the school. So students can express their Christian faith in assignments. In a period of classroom silence, they're free to pray. They're free to read scripture if they so choose. Separation of church and state just means that we cannot push anyone in religion. We cannot proselytize. Right? We don't want a state religion. That was the purpose of the First Amendment. But it does not preclude talking about moral values, spiritual values, being better citizens. And it doesn't mean that we cannot talk about religious values if, you know, within the context of the academic setting, rather than is, you know, a purely religious setting. So this is what happened, and I'll just give you one example of this. Parker Palmer, you're an educator, I'm sure you've heard of Parker Palmer. So he describes this experience he had teaching in Appalachia. It was in a college setting to a very conservative Christian community there, but this was in a college setting. And the Dalai Lama had visited that area, and one of the students was, you know, really upset, you know, saying, how can these people say that this particular boy, you know, that we look at these boys and we select one to be the next Dalai Lama, and then we raise him up. You know, how can they raise him up to be the next Dalai Lama? How can you do this? And so there were very disparaging remarks about you know, the faith of the Dalai Lama, of people who follow that, and some of them said, well, this is the Antichrist. You know, it's a very conservative Christian background. And this is what Parker Palmer said. In class, he said to the student, you know, in front of everyone, says, like you, I'm a Christian. And in our faith, there's something very similar that we have. We believe that Jesus was identified as an infant at even an earlier age than this boy that was selected to be the Dalai Lama. That we identify Jesus at an even earlier age. And so this then sparked discussion about how do we know what's real? How do we know what's true? And even months later, that particular student who raised that question told Parker Palmer that he was glad that for what he had said, what the teacher had said, and it had sparked his own thinking. Well, this is an example of some of the things that we can do. It takes place within the natural context of a class. But unless we're prepared to do it, and I think we can intentionally plan for some of these moments, and, you know, this one, of course, was not planned, but there are times we can plan for this. And it doesn't violate separation of church and state. It falls within the natural context of what is going on in classroom discussion. And this is, you know, so we're going to talk a little bit more about this as we go on. So how do we talk about this in the classroom? Okay, now. Daniel Goleman, I think 1995, was his bestseller, Emotional Intelligence, and this is what Goleman says. At best, IQ contributes about 20% to the factors that determine life success, which leaves 80% to other forces. Right? It's this other 80% we're talking about. EQ, emotional intelligence. How do you get along with people? Interpersonal skills. Are you aware of who you are? 80% is outside of IQ.
How does somebody come up with a figure like that?
How do they come up with a figure like that? I'm not sure, but Goleman talks about that. And you're welcome to challenge it. No, I'm not sure of his methodology.
You know, those are the kinds of statements that when I read, I always want to say, how did you decide to study? Mm-hmm. What was
right.
your protocol?
Mm-hmm.
What are the data?
Sure.
It's something that can't really be challenged. Somebody else could say, at best, IQ contributes 10%, or somebody mm-hmm. could say, IQ is very important, and it can produce a full 40%.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To me, that's a lovely statement.
Yeah, right. You certainly can dispute that.
I mean, the numbers.
Right, right. I understand the numbers. But if you just look at the principle,
yeah.
And I get,
the
you
principle
know, your point
that,
is well taken.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But it's the principle that, and I think as we get older in life, we realize that, you know, life, you know, the most successful person isn't the valedictorian in class.
Right.
I mean, the old thing, I don't know if you tell this joke in your classroom, but this is what we say in seminary, that you have to be careful about the grades you give to your students. Because your A students, they're going to come up, you know, come back, and they're going to be your professors in the seminary. Your B students and C students are the ones that will graduate and go on to be successful pastors and ministry workers. And your D students are the ones who will come back and be on the board of directors. So that's our saying in seminary. So if that's any indication of life success, it's not your high IQ folks per se, even though I think some of the D students probably have pretty good IQ, pretty high IQs, but it's because of these other factors. They know how to negotiate life. And, you know, how can we do that? Let me give you an example then of what happened in one school that promoted emotional intelligence programs. You have this little chunky kid, about second grade. He's walking in an empty hall room because class is in session, so the other students are in class. For whatever reason, he's in the hallways, and there's a teacher nearby who observes this interaction. Two slightly older and larger students come walking down the other side of the hall. They see this little chunky kid, and one of them says to him, "Hey, fatty, you stink at soccer. You suck on the soccer field." Little kid took a deep breath, squared his shoulders, and he said, "You're right. I'm not very good at soccer. But you're one of the best in the school at soccer. But you know what? I'm good at art, and I can draw just about anything." Well, that seemed to take the air out of this, you know, this bully. And he said, "Well, you're not all that bad. If you want, I'll show you some moves after school." And that, they kept on walking. Now, what happened? When that little kid was insulted, And he took this deep breath. This was part of his EQ training, that when you find yourself in a stressful situation, what you do is you take a deep breath, you calm yourself down. And then when he spoke, he gave what was known as a put up. Now, you know what a put down is. A put up is the opposite of a put down, where you say something positive. So he said something positive about his attacker. Then he said something positive about himself to level the playing field. And when he did that, that signaled to the other child, the older child, about what was going on, because he had also been, you know, he's in a school with this type of training, and even though he wanted to, you know, he bullied this little kid, it reminded him of what he should have done or should be doing. And that's why the situation then just de-escalated and went away. Now, if that little second grader had reacted the way other second graders normally would without this training, what would he have done? May have fought back verbally, physically, you know, may have shouted an insult back. He may have said nothing, especially if he is Asian, and just walked away and been scared for the rest of his life in that school as long as these kids were around. And maybe it would have affected his learning as he was stressed out by the situation in school. But these are the types of things that can happen in a positive direction when we begin incorporating schools of spirit, schools of soul, and incorporating these disciplines in our curriculum. So CASO, I don't know if you're familiar with CASO, stands for the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, CASEL, CASO. I don't know if you're familiar with CASO. This was founded in 1994. Daniel Goleman was one of the co-founders, by the way, along with Eileen Rockefeller, Groward. And their goal is to teach social and emotional skills in schools, in classrooms. And these are some of the charts that they have. Okay, we're going to. So in terms of social and emotional learning, okay, social emotional learning is the process whereby children and adults develop essential social and emotional skills, knowledge, and attitudes related to. And here we are with those three areas that we've already talked about. Self-awareness, recognizing one's emotions and values as well as one's strengths and limitations. Self-management, managing emotions and behaviors to achieve one's goals. And then these blue things, social awareness, showing understanding and empathy for others, relationship skills, forming positive relationships, working in teams, dealing effectively with conflict, and then responsible decision-making, making ethical, constructive choices about personal and social behavior. Again, the three areas we talked about, self-awareness, interpersonal skills, and community relationships. Something that we do for the good of the community. So they've introduced these programs into schools across different parts of the United States, and even internationally they've entered some schools. And I won't talk about that. I'll skip this. But and let me just put this screen up. I'm not going to talk about it, but you can read this for yourself about how this improves academic outcomes. Okay, so what I'm going to do is give you a little case study, and I just have these things up, you can look at it at your leisure. I'm going to give you a little case study to work on. And in this case study, let me pass it out, and then I'll put some questions up for you to look at. Okay, I printed 50, it might be enough, if not, if you can share. And if you can you talk in groups of four? How's that? Whatever your buddy pair was before at the beginning, if you were here, and then just find another buddy pair. And in groups of four, if you can talk about this. And because of time, let me give you about 10, 12 minutes to read this over and then to talk about this. And this is a real example of what happened in a situation where social and emotional learning was taken into account. If you can divide into your groups of four, or if you want to just stay in your two, you can do that too. And talk about this. Again, this is.
Yeah. Thank you.
Two more minutes. Together and talk about this situation. All right, can we all come back together again, please? All right. I want to give you enough time later at the end to talk about incorporation of your faith and how you can do this in your particular classroom situation and discipline. So we want to allow time to do that. And what we're doing right now is we're just building up to that point, all right? So I know we're talking about certain issues that you may not think is related to the higher ed classroom, but it's there. So anyway, what happened? By the way, what was the classroom age? What age class was it? What do you think?
I'm guessing kindergarten.
Kindergarten. Exactly. These are kindergarten kids. Kindergarten kids. All right, so what happened? Dynamics. What were the dynamics of the situation? What was going on? What types of transactions were going on here?
Expression of feelings.
Okay, expression of feelings.
It seemed like they had a set class time for sharing time. That he started sharing.
Uh-huh. Okay, so there was a place and time where feelings could be shared, is what you're saying. Okay? Yes.
So an opportunity for vulnerability.
Right. Okay, an opportunity for vulnerability, absolutely.
It was kind of a blanket where the other students could ask.
Okay.
The love.
Right. So, Carlos, as you pointed out, he felt safe enough to talk about his feelings. And of course, kids are a little more open and expressive than maybe adults are. And this is one of the things that they found. They said, Rachel Kessler said, when students are young, they come to class and they will talk about all these other areas of their lives other than academics. But they learn in the classroom as they get older that they're not supposed to talk about those things. So they shut down and they don't talk about it. And this is what we're saying, that this is part of all this effort. How do we get students to open up about these issues? So Carlos expressed his feelings, and they were validated. Right? The teachers validated his feelings. I mean, what could they have done? What else could they have done other than what they did?
Send them counseling.
Yeah, send them counseling service, or nothing. Yeah. Or said, okay, that's nice. Or, well, we're sorry that happened. Which is a validation of sorts, but it doesn't go any further. So what did the teachers do then? The teachers hear this emotional distress, and how did they respond?
Well, they saw a series of ways in which different students could react to that in a positive way, through the art, through the tabletop things.
Right.
Situation they had to make that possible.
Right. But in order to make that happen, well, here's the rhetorical question. Was this part of their lesson plan for the day? Obviously not. What they were able to do was to change course, right? To roll with the punches, to understand what was taking place and respond to it appropriately. And then they did these different things. They employed the arts, literature, acting. You know. They allowed the students, they provided these different ways to express feelings and thoughts through literacy and non-literate means. All right? So this is what happened. So what effect did it have on Carlos? How did Carlos feel, you think, after all this?
Understood.
Understood. Absolutely. What else?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And this is, this previous slide I had. When students are upset emotionally, socially, it affects their academic outcome. And you put this into the college situation. First time away from home, right? You have college freshmen. They're homesick. They miss their home. Do you think it affects academic performance? They break up with their boyfriend or girlfriend. They try to pledge and they're rejected. They can't find a new social circle of friends. They can't find a church that they feel comfortable in. These are social and emotional issues, and they affect academic outcome. So Carlos felt better. What effect do you think it had on the other students?
I think it would encourage them to be able to share openly as well, to be vulnerable, because they know that they might be cool if they reciprocated, but they would also be encouraged in this way.
Right. So the atmosphere of the class, the classroom atmosphere, it was a community. Would it be safe to say that there was some type of community, trust? Someone used the word vulnerability, a collaborative process. Would you like to be in a classroom like that? Would you like to be a teacher in a classroom like that? See, this is all part of when we begin talking about spiritual issues in your secular classroom. Why should the students be vulnerable? Why should they talk about personal issues in their lives? Why should they talk about social and emotional issues? It's because you've created a classroom. You and the students together have created a classroom where their feelings can be shared, can be understood, validated, where there's a community of trust, where sharing has already taken place on other issues. So now when you talk about spiritual issues, or soul and spiritual issues, moral values, they will feel comfortable sharing. It's like pastoring a church. It's the atmosphere. If you don't create an atmosphere of trust and community in the church, people aren't going to share. You can have a Sunday service. It doesn't mean it's a community. That's what you're trying to create in the classroom. And that's why I'm saying there's so many similarities between, church situations, classroom situations. It's what you do to create this and what those that are in your congregation or your classroom do to help this. So it all begins to blend into each other. It's integrated, not differentiated. Okay, so he didn't even turn around, but he heard. Okay. What effect did it have on the teachers? Well, I would hope that they felt better. All right. Now, in addition to emotional intelligence, there is another type of intelligence that Damon Zohar, Ian Marshall have uncovered in the psychological field, It's called spiritual intelligence. Right now we're getting at the real fun stuff that as Christians we want to talk about. And these are some categories that define what spiritual intelligence is. A high degree of self-awareness, knowing who we are, what our strengths and limits are, what we live for, the capacity to be inspired by vision and values, and caring that transcends self-interest, having a sense of service. Right? That's what Bishop Wright was talking about this morning. The ability to face and use suffering and transcend pain. Learning from mistakes, our own and those of others, acknowledging our weaknesses and cultivating our strengths. A holistic worldview, an ability to see connections between diverse things and see the bigger picture. So now we have a basis for talking about spiritual intelligence as an academic discipline. So how do we talk about this in the classroom? Jacob Lieberman, don't think he's a Christian at all. Decided that he was asked what class he'd like to teach, high school teacher. He was asked what type of experimental class he'd like to teach. And he said he wanted to teach philosophy. He didn't know why he, his interest wasn't philosophy, but he had never done this. And he said, well, he wanted to teach a class in philosophy. And in his class, these are the questions that he came up with. He says, these are the questions of philosophy. And are we alone in the universe? Who am I? Why do we suffer? Is death the end? What can we know? Why is there evil? What can we hope for? What ought we to do? How should we live? What is love? So these are some of the questions he came up with in this high school class. And he presented them as, well, these are some of the basic questions of life. Some of the basic philosophical questions of life. And you can see they're tied in, aren't they? Are they not with spiritual intelligence matters? So how do we talk about it? So in one particular classroom that they had, they were talking about ecology, ecological principles. And so the students were talking about ecology along with them. And when they were asked, well, how can we preserve our environment? These are some of the answers they came up with. They said, we need to change our lifestyles. Nations need to change their lifestyles. We need to develop technology that is more eco-friendly. We need to save the whales. We need to save the rainforest. But ultimately, one of the students has said, this will never happen because governments are selfish. I mean, what kind of opening is that? Talking about original sin, right? But governments are selfish. So here they are talking about ecology. Why do we talk about ecology in the first place? Why do we talk about preserving the planet? And so Needleman, at the end of the class, asks this question. He says, what is a human being? Isn't that where the discussion ultimately leads? Why should we be concerned about preserving the Earth? Obviously, it's to preserve human life. But then it leads to the question, what is a human being? Why is it that we're so important that we need to preserve human life? And then he ended with a follow-up question. And why are we on Earth? Why as human beings? Why are we on Earth? Secular classroom, getting into these issues of life. And you can do that too in your classrooms. To begin talking about this in the natural context of your discussion, touching on issues of spiritual intelligence and the bigger issues of life. Rachel Kessler, in the book, The Soul of Education, said there are seven gateways that students have. This is her particular theory. She's written a whole book on it. Every student, number one, searches for meaning and purpose, the existential questions of life. Questions such as, why am I here? Does my life have a purpose? How do I find out what it is? Sounds like Christian questions, doesn't it? But every person has these questions also. What does my future hold? Is there life after death? Is there a God? The second area. Second gateway, the longing for silence and solitude. And by that, there are several ways to look at it, but silence and solitude is taking a break so that you can have self-reflection, thinking about who you are. It deals with identity formation, goal setting, as well as finding inner peace. It says students long for silence and solitude. At West Point, are you familiar with contemplative practices? Yeah, some of you are. So at West Point, they started a contemplative fellowship. And the professor went in and taught these cadets how to meditate, how to, I guess, free writing, you know, ways in which they can just tap into another part of their being and find stillness. And as a follow-up, she found out that two of her students, husband and wife, went off to Iraq to serve as Black Hawk helicopter pilots, flying combat helicopters in Iraq. And they wrote to her and said that they still find meditation very helpful for them in the midst of war. With all this wartime, the battles going on, comrades dying, they found it important to still have time for meditation. The way he would do it is that he would put on his earphones, he said, so people would think that he was listening to his iPod, listening to music, and what he was doing was just meditating. So there's this longing for silence that we have, solitude. Third gateway, the urge for transcendence. And by transcendence, it means going beyond our limits, what we perceive to be our limits, but going beyond that. Example of that would be what happened in the Summer Olympics. Remember the swimming relay team? And this was the particular race that Michael Phelps would have the most difficulty in, they said, because it's a relay race, and the French were favored to win. And if you saw the race, you know, it was just an incredible race. The anchor runner for the U.S. team probably swam the best that he will ever swim, the fastest he will ever swim. And in that split second, he swam to victory. That's what transcendence is, going beyond your perceived limits. And that includes suffering. How much suffering can I take? How much stress can I take? You know, is there a power beyond me? Is there a power I can tap into? And so he says students ask these questions as well. The fourth one is the hunger for joy and delight. I think that's self-explanatory. Fifth is the creative drive. And usually we think of the arts when we talk about creativity. Music, art, which helps us as human beings to express sometimes what is within us, not with words, but with these other senses, with these other means. The call for initiation. And by initiation, this is what she means. That we go through different stages of life. And she says in America, you don't have real initiation rites. In other societies, when you go from childhood to adulthood, there is a ceremony that marks this. And in the United States, we don't have this. We don't really have, in most of our cultures, a call for initiation. So what we end up doing is teenagers engage in premarital sex because that's their way to mark initiation, right? When you lose your virginity. When you have an active sexual life, it means you're not a kid anymore. You become an adult. Or you go drinking, right? Alcohol. That's their way, that's your way of showing that you have gone from being a child to being an adult. Taking drugs. So she says these are self-destructive ways of initiation, and what we need to provide is other rites, our other rites of initiation. And so in the school, they do that. Do you want a story or not? Is it helpful to explain? Okay, let me read to you what happened. And so this is what Kessler writes. A senior honoring ceremony, senior in high school, designed to celebrate each graduating senior, not just a few. The teacher says to him, and this is in front of everyone in a ceremony. When you came into my class, I could tell that you were used to being one of the clowns. Yet when it came time to share our stories, you took the first risk. You inspired all of us with the courage of your vulnerability. I want to honor you for the warmth you brought to each one of us and the initiative and courage you've shown. I respect you as a leader and value you as a friend. The young man beams. His father behind him looks stunned. This is his younger son, the cut-up, the disappointment after the academic achiever who went before him, the one who has brought this father too many times to the disciplinary dean's office. Now, after listening to one of the most respected teachers in the school describe the outstanding gifts of character his boy has demonstrated in his final year of high school, the father's face begins to soften. Tears glisten. He places his hands on the broad shoulders of his son. One squeeze tells this boy that his father has heard, is willing to see him in a new light. In the father's eyes looms perhaps the largest question of all. What went right? And the answer, though elusive, is quite simple. At the heart of every adolescent experience is an exquisite opening to spirit, an awakening of energy when larger questions of meaning and purpose, of ultimate beginnings and endings, begin to press with an urgency much too powerful to be dismissed as hormones. What went right this year for this young man is that he found experiences that nourished his spiritual development. This secular school created a place for his soul, and he flourished. So this is what she means by initiation, where there is this, it's almost like a fellowship, where students are recognized for who they are. It's part of this caring cohort that they've been through, whether it's a particular class or a different type of situation. And they are recognized for what they've done, and they go through this rite of initiation. And she says, every student needs that, different stages of initiation in life. And we'll come back to this. And then finally, she says, undergirding everything is the yearning for deep connection, that as human beings, we all want to be connected in a community with other people. We all want this. So these are her seven gateways. And what then, you know, are some of the implications for what our students also are looking for? They want to talk about spiritual issues. They want to talk about moral issues, meaning in life, purpose. How can we do that? So let me give some examples of ways that have been done, and then I'm going to set you loose to talk with each other and see how you can incorporate some of these concepts into your own setting. Okay, this is a health class in Colorado, and in addition to teaching health, the teacher said they're also going to talk about social and emotional skills. In addition to just talking about health issues, social and emotional skills, they established a caring, or at least some type of trusting atmosphere in the class, an initial trust atmosphere of trust. And then students were asked to write down anonymously the questions that were in their minds and on their hearts. And then the teacher would read them out loud. They didn't know who, you know, wrote these questions, but these are some of the questions that they came up with. Gosh, I have this in the wrong order. Let's see if I have it. Nope. Okay, I thought I had this. Let me read to you then some of these questions. Why am I here? Does my life have a purpose? Why this emptiness in this world in my heart? Why do people hate others, black, white, Hispanic? Why are people so careless with our planet? Is there anyone out in the world like me? So questions like this, and she says what happens is that when the students see these other questions, they recognize that others have the same issues that they do, that these are not unique to themselves. Begins to open up discussion. But what they did with these questions was that they passed this on to the other teachers in the school to answer. And these other teachers were against this health class being constructed and developed in this manner. Health class is health class. Why are you talking about social and emotional areas? And when they began seeing the questions that emerged, it changed the school curriculum. It changed the school to begin incorporating these aspects of life into their curriculum. So, again, that's one example of what happened when we start talking about social-emotional issues, but having anonymous questions. That's one way in which you can begin talking about these matters. Another example. The council method, and this is what Kessler talks about, where what you do is you establish, again, a small group, your classroom, you established a trust, some type of trust. Ice-breaking exercises, you know, we do that in church. Icebreakers, you know, initial sharing questions. You develop some type of intimacy and trust. And then you begin to talk about some of the deeper issues. And it could be an issue raised by the teacher. It could be an issue raised by classroom instruction. It could be some interaction about life issues. But you gather in a group, in a circle where everyone can see each other. And you can pass around an object. Sometimes you use a rock. Whoever wants to talk has to be holding the rock. And when you hold the rock, no one else can speak. Right? And when you're through, you pass it, and you know, then the next person talks. And so it is in this type of setting that the students begin to share about perhaps issues that were raised in their classes and how it relates to life, how it relates to their life. In a different classroom setting, it could be a journal that they keep. And once a week, they'll meet in this council, and they will take some of the things that were written in their journal, and they will share it in their little group. And this then begin to spark discussion about spiritual issues. So, how do you get a classroom of students? You may be thinking, your students, you know, how do I get my students to share like this? And this is what Kessler says. At the very beginning of the semester, she interacts with the students, and together they set up the guidelines. She describes the process, that this is what they're going to do. And she said, if you're going to have this take place, what are the ground rules that we're going to set up so that this can happen?
I'm sorry.
That's all right. And these then...
I will survive. We had a death in our family yesterday.
Oh, we're sorry. These are the rules the students universally come up with. Listening for understanding, meaning if someone shares, you try to understand what they're saying. No put-downs, bagging, or dissing, that you can't put down another person for whatever they've shared. Openness, respect, honesty, the right to be silent if they don't want to talk. Honor given to the privacy of what is spoken, or confidentiality, that you will not share outside your circle. Okay, so these are the rules. So you're thinking, well, how can I do this in my classroom? I would suggest the same types of, same situation where you agree with the students. That's one way of doing it. The other way is, you can lay these rules down, but universally. This is the experience she has. These are the rules the students come up with. And this creates then a climate for how this takes place. And so in a particular class, let's say an English class, and you can read whatever you want, but let's say To Kill a Mockingbird, talking about issues of prejudice. And so you keep a private journal. And every student has to have a journal. End of the week, maybe the teacher gets to look at it, maybe make some comments, put it back, but no one else sees it, gives it back. But during these council times, whenever you hold them, the students are free to share about how they have interacted with the material, how they interact with it, and share it with others, and then that begins then this class discussion. And it transcends class. You know, now you're beginning to get issues of life. Again, you can't talk about Christianity directly, but it gets at these issues, and you're helping your students. Another example, this is what one high school English teacher did with Brave New World. So in Brave New World, Huxley looks at a world that is different from ours. And these are some of the questions then that she asked. Soma is used heavily by the citizens of the world state to escape their daily lives. It is a magical drug because it allows one all the benefits of being drunk without being high, without the nuisance of hangovers, In our own society, many people turn to drugs and alcohol to escape from their problems. Is this appropriate? Another question. Sex is a commodity in the world state. Citizens are conditioned to believe that everyone belongs to everyone. Why does this seem a skewed way to approach sex? Or is it? Why do we believe in institutions like marriage? The citizens of the world state mock the concept of organized religion, but we see that their beliefs are essentially a religion. What is religion then? Is it an inherent or necessary part of society? And then in Brave New World, they had babies born from test tubes, if you're familiar with the novel. And so she brought in her husband, who happens to be a geneticist, to talk about issues of cloning. And you can get into issues of ethics of cloning. Can you begin touching on moral values, spiritual values, getting people to examine what do they believe, why do they believe it? And as the students share, some of them are going to be Christians. They can bring in the Christian perspective. You may not be able to, but students can. And this gets, now you open people up to talking about it. So I've thought a little bit about this, and I was thinking, well, how do you do this in some of your disciplines, which may be very remote from English, which is far easier? Well, how about team teaching at points? An interdisciplinary part of your course, where you bring in a professor from a related discipline, an unrelated discipline, to touch upon these issues. Again, biology, ethics, cloning with English, religion with biology. I mean, there are different combinations you can try. So what I want to do then is give you some time now to think about this. You know, it's a lot of stuff I've thrown out at you, but in your teams of two or four, whatever you decided on, reflect upon, you know, how can you then incorporate some of these things into your own classroom situation? Do you see how you can do it? Okay, so I'm going to give you about 10 minutes.
Can I ask you?
Sure.
Is there any way that we could do a breakout by the area that we're doing?
Sure. I thought of that too. I didn't know it was too complicated.
I don't know if there's too many
fields.
There perhaps
exactly.
Like a K-12 and maybe like a higher ed.
Yeah, we can do that. K to 12? Where are the K to 12s? There were just several before at the beginning. So maybe we can put the K to 12 at the front. That's the easiest. And then the rest of you, I guess, are all in higher ed, right? So then I guess whatever discipline you're in, if you can just share with your group, you know, and just reflect upon some of these things, you know, what are ways in which you think you can do this? You know, does it speak to you at all about how you can do this? So take about 10 minutes to do this. And then let's talk. It's just the two of you?
Yeah. Just fine. We'll make sure that we'll pause it for a little bit.